BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Football Daily with Mark Chapman.
Some of the biggest names in football have joined the league. Attendances at stadia have skyrocketed and the world has been forced to sit up and take notice. So having gained our attention, the Saudi Pro League is determined to keep it. How globally significant in the football world can it become? And for the players and fans, will the sporting project ever outweigh financial incentives? This is part one of the Saudi story.
Cristiano Ronaldo has completed his move to Saudi Arabian side Al Nassr.
I'm happy here. I want to continue here. The Saudi League can be in the fifth in the world.
The Portugal captain will earn more than £177 million a year.
Here is Henderson. Henderson scores!
It is already influential, but we will have to learn to deal with it, and that's what we do.
Steven Gerrard has a new job in the Saudi Pro League.
Left foot shot, it's Mahrez again! It's a hat-trick!
Saudi Arabian clubs have as much right to purchase players as any other does. All good competitions have to have revenue streams to back them up.
Al Hilal have submitted a world record bid of £259 million for Kylian Mbappe.
Oh, what a finish! What a finish from Benzema!
Money buys everything. The criticisms will fade away and we will become a powerhouse in sport. And that's exactly what they're becoming.
So with us throughout the show, Ahmed Al-Omron, a Saudi journalist based in the city of Jeddah, formerly of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. Evening, Ahmed. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also we have Adam Crafton of The Athletic as well. And there is a lot to get into. Probably the best place to start is to get an introduction into modern-day Saudi Arabia. Ahmed lives and works there. We're going to bring in Samir Hashmi as well, BBC Middle East business correspondent who covers the Gulf region. Thank you very much for being with us. Ahmed, I want to start with you, though. Living and working there now in Saudi Arabia, how would you describe the country?
It's been going through a lot of changes. The last 6 or 7 years have seen a lot of rapid change take place in the country. As the Crown Prince came to power in 2015, he started or launched this major economic and social reform program called Vision 2030 that seeks to diversify the economy, but also open up society and make it more socially liberal. So we've seen the country has gone under a lot of change over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And yeah, it's some of these changes are things that many portions of the population have asked for a long time, and they're happy to see it finally implemented and embraced. But at the same time, the speed of this change can be dizzying sometimes, and some people find it a bit alienating. So all in all, it's been very exciting to witness and report on and observe, but also sometimes hard to explain, especially for people on the outside.
Samir, Vision 2030, as Ahmed has just mentioned, that project dominates the way of operating, does it, within Saudi at the moment?
Absolutely. I mean, that is really at the heart of this transformation, which has led to this economic and social change, which you're seeing, which Ahmed was also referring to. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has set certain targets. Now, if you talk about Saudi Arabia, essentially, traditionally, it's always been a country that has relied on oil exports to drive its economy. I mean, even today, 40% of the money that goes to the treasury, Saudi treasury, comes from oil exports. So they have relied heavily on oil revenues to take the country forward. But now there's a realization in Saudi Arabia that with climate change becoming a important issue globally, demand for oil is going to decline over the next decade or two. So peak oil demand is here for another 10 years or so, and that's when they can maximize and make those petrodollars. But they need to find new revenue streams in order to keep the country going 20, 30 years from now. So how do you do that? And that is how economic, the Vision 2020 came up, which has focuses on creating non-oil industries, whether it's sports, tourism, entertainment, technology, investing in these sectors, which will create jobs and also help the economy reduce its dependence on oil exports.
Sami, hi, it's Adam here. If the argument is this is all about diversifying the economy, when you look at the numbers that are being spent on sort of aging footballers from European leagues, where do they see a return on investment? If this is, you know, this is about making money, diversifying the economy, is that a very short-sighted view from me? And are they therefore taking this view on investment in sport as a seriously long-term project in order to get a return?
I don't think they are looking at this as a project to make any kind of return on investment in the short term. I think the Saudis realize that. If you look at Saudi Arabia, the reason for investing so much on sports and especially football, it's more of a branding exercise for them to really bring the eyeballs, the global eyeballs on Saudi Arabia, which will help them in other sectors, for example, tourism. Now, they have set a huge target that they want 10 million tourists coming to Saudi Arabia every year by 2030. Now, traditionally, Saudi Arabia has seen a lot of religious tourism, where people have come to the Islamic holy cities of Makkah and Medina for Hajj and for pilgrimage. But now they want to promote leisure tourism. And they think that football and sports could play a big role in changing the perception of Saudi Arabia. Because remember, there is that challenge for them that globally the perception about Saudi Arabia is that it's a very closed country. There are human rights issues. So there is an image problem over there. And they think that they can address it by investing in sports. Many critics call it sports washing. So that's one way of looking at it. But the Saudis are looking at it as a branding exercise, which will help influence other sectors of the economy, tourism being one, entertainment being other. And of course, it will raise their global profile. So if this football league becomes big and becomes a talking point, a lot of people are going to tune in to watch Saudi football. And in any case, Saudi Football League has been very popular in the Arab world because the quality of the league is quite good, especially if you look, compare it to other Asian countries. So they have managed to attract some of the best players from Asia. But now what they're expecting is that this, by signing these aging players, superstars, it could elevate them to the next level and they could become one of the top leagues, football leagues in the world.
Ahmed, we talk about diversifying the economy and what they are trying to do. And also Sami has talked about the external eyeballs. How important is all of this internally? This is what I find quite interesting as well. You know, you look at the statistics, 70% of the Saudi population is under the age of 35. 60% is under 30. So how much is this a ploy to keep the younger generations happy?
I think they both feed into each other. I mean, as you mentioned, this is a very young population and they are football mad. They are obsessed with football and football has always been the biggest sport and the biggest pastime in the country. So, you know, from a local perspective, it does make sense for the government to invest in a sector that has always been popular, has always been attractive to the majority of the young people in the country. And from the economic perspective, they also see, as Samir mentioned, they identified sports and tourism as the two sectors where they see a lot of potential for growth and job creation for these young Saudis who are the majority of the population. If these sectors can grow and become more economically active and larger part of the economy, they will create jobs that eventually feed into the economic diversification plan. So in that regard, they feed into each other. And as he also mentioned, that will also help with attracting tourism, which is also another engine for job creation.
I have heard it said, and I put this to Frank Gardner, the BBC security editor, who we'll hear from a little bit later on, but I have heard it said that there is an element of whether it's football, whether it's gaming, whether it's bringing big concerts to Saudi, whether it's bringing heavyweight fights to Saudi, it can be used as a way of placating the younger generations who tend to be politically savvy or a bit more worldly wise. They can see what's going on elsewhere in the world, and therefore they won't necessarily complain as much if they've got all these things being brought to them. Is that a fair theory?
It is a factor into these wave of changes. So this is a country that used to be very closed and very restrictive. And for a lot of these young people, they used to seek entertainment outside the country. They used to escape it in order to see their favorite artists or to, you know, watch their favorite stars. The fact that they can have this entertainment now at their doorstep, that they don't feel the need to travel and leave the country to have fun, is definitely a factor that makes people, you know, come to the conclusion that, you know, this situation is good. The situation in the country is improving. So you don't have a reason to protest or to demand for more rights. But over time, that will also change, because some of these changes that young people are embracing now because they are new and fresh, in a few years down the road, people will take them for granted and people will start to ask, you know, what is more in this for me? What else do I want from my life, my career, my, you know, my living standard, all these questions. So you can think of it as a factor, but it's not a perfect ploy. It's not a drug that people will happily take and that will ensure that, you know, they cannot protest or demand more rights if they're inclined to.
Samir, tell us more about Mohammed bin Salman then. Forbes ranked him as the eighth most powerful person on the planet. He was the youngest in the top 10. And in that article that Forbes wrote, they said he's undeniably charismatic. He's in this weird position where he's in charge of everything in his country, but he also exudes the belief that he's qualified to do it all.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story when it comes to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and his rise has been so rapid that has really caught the attention of the world. I mean, he is the son of the current ruler, King Salman, who became king in 2014. And as soon as he became the king, in 2015, I'm sorry, and as soon as he became king, he appointed Prince Salman as the second in line as the deputy prime minister and the minister for defense. Usually, if you look at Saudi Arabia, how the monarchy has worked in the Al Saud family, that usually the throne has got passed on from one brother to another between the various sons of Al Saud Abdulaziz, who was the founder of the country. But here, King Salman made a big shift when it comes to passing on the throne, because he appointed his nephew as the successor, as the crown prince, and the deputy successor was Mohammed bin Salman. But within a year, his nephew was removed from his post and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was the second in line and he was appointed as the crown prince. And since then, he has literally consolidated political power in the country. He took some controversial steps that includes, you know, whether it's going and fighting the war in Yemen, which was considered hugely controversial, or also, you know, going for the purge, where he basically went after a lot of big businesses and entrepreneurs in the country, and which had public support at that point of time, because he said these are people, you know, there are people in the system who are corrupt, and this money has been made through corruption, and he was able to ask those people to actually give money back to the government. And there was a lot of popular support for him when he did that a few years ago. And since then, Mohammed bin Salman has only risen. And now he is not only the de facto ruler, but officially he's also the prime minister of the country. So he really calls all the shots and he is deeply involved in all the mega projects, whether it's the economic vision to the 2030 plan, whether it's the major political decisions that have been taken. Interestingly, under him, we've also seen a geopolitical shift, the way Saudi Arabia is now trying to position itself as an important player on the world stage. So we have seen a huge shift on that front. But one thing he's really focused about is definitely this economic vision, because he sees this as a transformational, not only for the country, but for the generations to come. And remember, he's only 37, 38. So he has, you know, a long time ahead of him. And he expects to rule this country for a long time. And he wants to transform the country under his watch, and which is why he's taken all these steps.
Samir, is he also focused on a crackdown of freedom of expression? Because that's what Amnesty told us ahead of this programme, that since he came to power in 2015, There's been a wide-scale crackdown on freedom of expression, targeting the human rights community, as well as a range of individuals who've expressed any form of dissent or criticism of the government.
Well, that's true. There has been, the government has definitely cracked down on any form of dissent, any form of criticism. In fact, there have been many cases detained. Their families haven't heard about them. So that has definitely become much more stricter under his regime. And there has been a lot of criticism externally and also internally. If you talk to a lot of people, they won't, of course, say it out publicly, but they do express this fear that, you know, they don't want to say anything that can be perceived to be against the government, especially on social media, because there have been a number of cases where Saudis, young Saudis, who have said anything against the government, they have been arrested or detained. And that's a fear in the society, I think, and Ahmed could throw more light on it probably since he lives there, but this is what I've heard. But then on the other hand, there is also a lot of support for him among young people who are willing to, you know, turn a blind eye on those issues and focus on the positive things, as they call it, whether it's opening up the economy or easing the social norms for women, whether it's driving or whether working or whether traveling. I mean, this is a huge shift for Saudi women. If you talk to a lot of them, they think their lives have transformed. They'd never imagined this would happen. But yes, there is no denying that the human rights record has become more questionable under this regime.
And Ahmed, given that fear then that Samir talked about, is this difficult for you to do a show like this, or are you okay?
I'm okay, but you know, journalism has always been a difficult gig in this part of the world, and that's not just the case for Saudi Arabia. That's the whole Middle East. It's never been easy for journalists to operate in this part of the world.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. Ahmed stays with us throughout the course of the show, as does Adam. We'll say bye to Samir Hashmi, BBC Middle East business correspondent. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to talk next to BBC Sports editor Dan Rowan. You've previously, Dan, spoken to the Saudi sports minister, and we'll hear some of that later on. But for the first part of this show, you've interviewed a board member on the Saudi Pro League. So take us through this.
Yeah, evening, Mark. His name is Peter Hutton. He's British, but during a 35-year-long career, he's also become known as one of the most experienced sports industry experts globally. He's been the CEO of Eurosport. He was an executive at ESPN, the sports agency IMG. He was also the head of sport at Facebook. Today, he's a consultant to various sports bodies, including the Saudi Pro League, where he was made a member of the board, in fact, earlier this year, in a bid to help them boost commercial revenues through sponsorship and broadcast deals. Now, so far, the senior figures behind the Pro League have kept a very low profile, declining our interview requests. But earlier this evening, Hutton did agree to speak to me from California, where he's based. And I started by asking him whether even he had been surprised by the remarkable recruitment drive that has shaken up the international transfer market.
I've worked in sport for 40 years now, and I've never seen a project as big as this, as ambitious as this, and maybe as determined as this to be a success. And I think the bit that really attracted me to it is the fact that it's not just about headline players and about the sort of big glamorous transfer fee and wages. It's also about the whole Saudi football infrastructure, whether that be women, whether that be youth, creating a whole pyramid that really transforms the sport in the country. I love the scale of that vision, and seeing it come into practice is remarkable.
What do you think is the ultimate ambition, Peter, of the Pro League? I mean, do you believe it can realistically soon rival major European leagues?
I think the main ambition is really to do what every league tries to do, right? Which is to create stories, to make people excited, invigorate the sport in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's the first and foremost ambition. It clearly wants to be one of the better leagues in the world, but I think the best part of it is about what can we do within the country, what can we create, what sort of dreams, what sort of ambitions can we stimulate for both young women and young male players.
And you truly believe that, do you? Because you'll have heard the criticisms, Peter, you'll have heard the arguments raised by human rights campaigners and others that they believe that this is ultimately another example of sports washing by a Middle Eastern country trying to use sport to distract from human rights issues and present a more positive image of the country. Do you accept there's any credence in that argument to a certain extent, or do you reject it?
I think, you know, what I look at is the evidence that I see on the ground, you know, and you've now got 50,000 schoolgirls playing football. You've got 1,000 women coaches. You've got this huge increase in terms of people being employed in the kingdom. You know, 2018, there were 750 registered coaches. Now there's over 5,500. So you see that as evidence of change. And I think you see the women's football development as part of societal change. And that, for me, is the real attraction of this project. I see a load of sport around the world. I'm really lucky to go to lots of events. The best thing that I saw last year was the final game of the Saudi Women's League, where the title was clinched with a goal in extra time. The crowd went crazy. You'd got young Saudi women, you know, genuinely there as heroines of a big crowd, which was a mixed crowd. And that was a fantastic thing to see, you know, remarkable change from what would have been there a decade ago.
Whether it's Cristiano Ronaldo or Jordan Henderson or Mane or whoever it is, Benzema, I mean, how exciting is this current recruitment drive? How significant do you see it?
I mean, it's clearly remarkable. You know, it's clearly got the world of sport talking. But then, you know, you look at the sort of money that's been spent on players. It's what, a quarter or a fifth of what the Premier League have spent this summer. So I think you still have to keep it in the context of that. I think also important to say, you know, 57 top international women players have gone in, particularly from the MENA region. But you're certainly seeing a transformation of the football in the country in a remarkable way.
Is this designed to some extent, Peter, do you think, to prepare the way for a World Cup bid? Are you expecting that for 2030?
I mean, I'm not a part of that process, but I think it's certainly important that we're seen as credible within the world of football as a whole. You've got the FIFA Club World Cup coming there shortly. You've got Asian-level competitions coming there shortly. So, you know, I think there's an increasing role for the kingdom within the world of big football events. But I think for me, look, the focus is very much about the Saudi Premier League and about the Saudi Women's League and how do we establish those and grow those competitions.
Are commercial and media revenues increasing, Peter, as a result of Ronaldo's arrival last season? And do you expect this latest influx of talent to boost revenues even further?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we can see the evidence in terms of real numbers in. You know, what happened when Ronaldo signed for Al Nassr was that we suddenly had this interest from international broadcasters. We did short-term agreements with broadcasters just for one season. We've now brought in IMG, one of the biggest organisations in the sports market in the world. They're selling the rights for the next two seasons, and we've seen huge increases. I mean, it's clearly something that's caught the imagination of broadcasters worldwide. And that's been a really positive sign to see.
Any idea how close a UK broadcast deal is? I mean, how long will it be until we can watch Pro League games live here?
I'd be confident we'll get a broadcast deal in the UK done for this coming season.
Where would you say Pro League teams are in terms of English football? What would be the equivalent level, would you say, in terms of standards and talent? I mean, I know it's improving rapidly now, but, you know, do you think... are we at a stage soon where some of the top Saudi teams could compete with some of the biggest teams in Europe? How far away are we from that?
Well, I think you can look at the World Club Cup last year, right? And Al Hilal got to the final, didn't disgrace themselves, did a very impressive performance. And this is the thing about Saudi football, that people, particularly this new investment, are talking about it's almost sort of beginning today, whereas clearly it's established its credibility over quite a long time. You know, it's got to the World Cup six times since 94, that you look at the under-23 Asian champions, the women's team is now FIFA ranked and going up the system. You know, there's proof points there that the quality is rising, and the proof points are about competition with other international teams and other international leagues. Clearly a huge long way to go, but the Saudi League has 50 years of tradition behind it. It has established fans for established clubs. This is a real competition that we're trying to upgrade as opposed to starting something new.
And Peter, how long realistically do you think this current recruitment drive we're seeing can be sustained for? Does that depend on your and your team's ability to generate revenue through broadcast and sponsorship? Because that's, as you said, that's going to take some time. So realistically, to continue spending at this level, how long can that go on for? Or do you think such is the commitment from the government and the Crown Prince himself, it doesn't really matter what happens commercially, you've got backing for a certain number of years?
I think the budgets are in place for a number of years. You know, I don't see this slowing down. But I also see welcome signs with, the, for example, PIF, the Public Investment Fund, taking over four of the clubs. Those clubs will transition from being government-owned clubs to being private-owned clubs. And I think you can see this in different areas of Saudi life, that the idea that things that were completely government-owned become more private businesses. And then I think you'll begin to see the clubs operate on a model which is more similar to the European model. You know, at the moment, the player acquisition is done centrally. You know, it's done by the league effectively and work with the clubs to allocate the players to the clubs. You know, that will clearly develop into far more independent club system with a far more independent club economy. But that will take time, and we sort of wait for that transition to sort of gradually materialise.
You'll have heard, Peter, I'm sure, this suggestion that this form of multi-club ownership with PIF effectively controlling four Pro League clubs could lead to a potential conflict of interest, given the Sovereign Wealth Fund's ownership of Newcastle United, the fact that it's thought to have had a stake as well in the majority owner of Chelsea, and when there are deals between clubs such as Chelsea or Newcastle and Saudi clubs, that gives that gives reason for suspicion about whether or not there could be some kind of advantage being afforded certain clubs because of those links. Does it affect the integrity of European football potentially? What's your view on all of this?
Oh, look, I think you've got to see it in the context of multi-club ownership as a whole, right? And UEFA have cleared now ownership of same clubs to play against each other in UEFA League games. You know, this is not unique to the kingdom. This is a problem that will grow and grow. You know, I'm based out here in California, and we're surrounded by people who are looking at that multi-club model. I think, you know, multi-club models are a challenge that world football has to face, no matter who is the ultimate owner of the multi-club group.
Jordan Henderson's move to Saudi Arabia was accompanied with some controversy because of his support in the past of the LGBTQ plus community. And there has been, as I mentioned earlier, these concerns raised about sports washing. Do you think some of the criticism that someone like Jordan Henderson has received is unfair, to be expected? Is there some validity to it? Because, you know, these are familiar arguments. We heard David Beckham recently speak about why he felt the need to be an ambassador for the Qatar World Cup, given the human rights concerns there. And he said, well, I'd rather engage, and through engagement, we can see progress. And people quote the fact that there's been labour reforms in Qatar. Many feel they haven't gone enough yet. They're still to be enacted properly. Where do you sit on this debate about the tensions that inevitably arise when football seeks to go to new territories and countries look to invest in the game, players come there, but with that comes concern about whether they're being used? I guess it's something which maybe you would have weighed up, given all your experience in the past. You don't need to be working for the Saudis. Is something which you wrestled with or thought about?
I think obviously you look at who you're working for and who you're working with, and that's a big part of what you choose to do. But the sovereign wealth funds are involved everywhere. You know, so many companies in the UK and the US have stakes from the Middle East sovereign wealth funds. You know, it's very difficult to say, I have no connection with this market or that market, because sometimes you just don't know and you find out later. For me, the reason that I got involved with what's happening in the KSA was I saw some of the stuff that was happening on the ground. My wife worked in women's football in FIFA. She was aware of what was happening in the kingdom. And you see that change. You see the people involved and how much joy they're bringing to the local community. I think that's a great thing to be involved in, you know, and it's always good to be there at a time of change. And particularly the changes in the role of women in Saudi society are remarkable. You know, this is moving very fast. Clearly from Western eyes, it could move a lot faster, but it has moved remarkably in the context of the history of the kingdom.
That was a Saudi Pro League board member Peter Hutton speaking to Dan Rowe, and Dan is still with us. Adam and Ahmed are as well. It's a question to all three of you, and Dan, you go first because obviously you were doing the interview. What did you make of all of that?
Well, I think it was a rare and an interesting insight, Mark, into the thinking behind what's trying to be achieved. I think there'll be an unusual level of interest perhaps in the Club World Cup, which up until now, you know, hasn't been seen that seriously by many fans. But I think, you know, Man City are in it this year, and I think Al-Ittihad of the Pro League with the likes of Benzema and Kante and Fabinho, they're going to be part of it. So there'll be more interest this time around. So whether that leads to that will be interesting. I also thought his defence of being involved, I mean, I suppose this is something which, as you heard me say, reflects what Beckham said this week about, you know, defending being an ambassador for the Qatar World Cup. You know, this is something which Jordan Henderson is going to have to address at some point soon. He hasn't yet. I think, you know, it does make me wonder, like someone like Peter Hutton, who's so experienced, is it just about the money that's on offer, which is what obviously many people suspect is the reason the footballer's going there, or is it because they genuinely believe some good can come of this? That is ultimately the sort of fundamental debate, I think, that's raging about all this.
Dan, thank you very much for being with us. Dan Rowan, BBC Sport Editor. And that is a problem, Adam, and, you know, saw it with a lot of the golfers who went to live, who claimed it was about growing the game. And do you know what? There may be an element of that. Who are we to doubt Peter Hutton's motives for doing it? But because there is such a ridiculous amount of money involved, sometimes you wonder whether actually, if the first thing they go, well, obviously there's a financial element, first of all, actually drawing attention to the financial element might give them a little bit more slack.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one of the problems with this, and actually I think in some ways it does a disservice to the story that we were hearing earlier in the show around the developments that are taking place in Saudi Arabia. When you kind of hear players, who everyone knows the figures involved, right? So it gives this huge dose of cynicism to whoever is making those arguments. And the thing that really undermines the argument is, you know, if you look at Beckham and Qatar, he said, well, I went because I need to engage and to communicate. But when he was there, he didn't communicate and he didn't engage and he didn't say anything. Nobody could get him to do a media interview for the whole time of the World Cup. And in the same way as, you know, these players who are going out there now, the male players, I mean, you know, well, so far, the only thing that we've actually seen from Jordan Henderson is a promotional video that was done from the Al-Ettifaq social media account that where the colour scheme of what was previously a rainbow armband was greyed out. And we've not heard Jordan Henderson talk about any of this at all. And I think that makes it very, very difficult to kind of believe at this point that the motivation goes beyond money. And that doesn't mean that the motivation of the people behind the project, the Saudis behind the project, it doesn't mean that their intentions aren't genuine in terms of diversifying the economy or liberalising the society. But I think the kind of players going from European leagues, I think at the moment, I think everyone knows what it's about.
Because then, and that's just to sort of balance that up a bit, Ahmed, as well, I'm sure I wasn't the only one whose ears pricked up when Peter Hutton talked about there are 50,000 girls playing in Saudi Arabia, that there are 1,000 female coaches in Saudi Arabia, that the competitive nature of the Saudi Women's League. So there were other elements of that interview that your ears do prick up and go, oh, okay, so that is happening, which I think a lot of people in the West don't know.
I mean, there's definitely progress, and, you know, the commitment to, you know, growing sports, woman empowerment in sports has been obvious and has been clear for those of us who live here to see. Women are allowed in the stadium, unlike Iran, for example, where women are still not in the stadiums. The Women's League has been running now for its second season and is doing very well. The national women team just finished their camp in Europe, and they're playing regularly now. So all these are good steps that have been taken, and they're very positive. The question now comes down to how sustainable they are, and how do you ensure that this is not just a temporary thing now because you need to host the World Cup and you need to have a women's team in order to be able to host the World Cup. How do you make sure that this is a long-term project? The government insists, yes, they are committed for the long term, that this is about development of society and making sure that both men and women have access to sports and can practice them regularly, because they also see obesity and health problems as a serious thing that they need to tackle. And they see the growth of sport as a way to deal with one of these problems. But we'll have to wait and see. We're still in really going through the early days of this change now. And we're talking about this as if it was a brand new thing. But as many people say, Saudi football has a long tradition. The league has been, you know, running for many, many decades. And it's not the first time that Saudi also spends heavily on sport. I mean, if you go back to the late 70s, the son of another king, the late Prince Faisal bin Fahd, signed a £25 million deal with former Coventry manager Jimmy Hill to become the country's first director of football at the time. And they tried to bring in big football stars. They brought in Rivellino, who won the World Cup with Brazil in 1970. He ended up retiring in Saudi Arabia playing for Al Hilal. So this is not the first time they tried to do this. And, you know, over the decades, we've seen many big names come to Saudi as players, as coaches. But, you know, the scale now is different. The amount of money and the numbers involved are much larger. But it's not their first rodeo.
Ahmed, can I ask, in terms of, as you say, you know, these changes that I think most people in the West would welcome, women in stadiums, more girls involved in sport, has there been a pushback from more conservative elements of Saudi society over the last couple of years in response to that? And is there some sort of concern that if things were to move even faster in terms of equality on other things, whether, I don't know, LGBT rights or further equality for women, that it would provoke a backlash that would be difficult to control for the state?
We don't know for sure. It's very hard to gauge. You know, the government insists that the majority of the population, these young people, are all embracing this change and very supportive of these changes. But, you know, for sure, there is a conservative segment of society who might not be very comfortable with, you know, some aspects of this, of these changes, the social liberalization, things like that. And it is unclear whether there is something that they would consider a step too far. As Samir mentioned earlier, it's harder to gauge these things because, you know, the margin for freedom of expression has become smaller. So part of it is anecdotal. You live sometimes and you hear people privately raise some concerns, but it's very hard to get a real gauge or a sense of how conservative people feel about these changes when they don't have the avenues to express themselves.
We have, over the last 40 minutes, spent a fair bit of time talking about the ethical issues involved with this story. We're going to hear next from Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent. He was ambushed by Al-Qaeda gunmen when working in the capital city, Riyadh, in 2004. He suffered life-changing injuries. His colleague, the cameraman, Simon Cumbers, was killed. Frank has told us about what's changed in the country since he was attacked.
The real change to Saudi Arabia has come in the last 5 years with the arrival of the Crown Prince on the scene. This is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is a controversial figure because he's still largely a pariah in most of the West, because he is blamed by Western intelligence agencies as having almost certainly ordered the murder and dismemberment of the Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But he's very popular at home. He's relatively young. He's in his early 30s. And he is pushing forward a program of social and employment development in Saudi Arabia that is going to try and future-proof the country. Now, we don't know if it's going to work, but young Saudis like him because they're used to being ruled by crusty old men who are totally out of touch with the youth of the country. And Saudi Arabia is a young country. It's got quite a high population growth, and most people are under 30. The weird thing is that on the one hand, he is freeing up society. He's allowed women to drive. I know that's going to sound weird in 2023, but that's the way it was. The religious leaders in Saudi were always against women being allowed to drive. They didn't want to see the mixing of the sexes. They thought it would lead to ungodly acts, and that also that if women were allowed to drive, they would simply crash into things. I'm serious that those are some of their quotes. So he's allowed that. He's allowed the opening up of cinemas, of concerts, of Formula One, Formula E racing. He's brought in a massive program of sports. He is building this huge infrastructure project in the northwest of the country called NEOM, a kind of city of the future. Again, we don't know if it's actually going to work. The idea is that thousands of people will flock to want to live there. That's not certain. But anyhow, he's trying to wean Saudi Arabia off oil. Now, the flip side to all of this is that in conjunction with these social reforms that have made Saudi Arabia a much nicer place to visit and to live in, he has cracked down massively on anything that looks like political dissent. Not even political dissent, but people who question, even in a single tweet, what the government is doing. And he has zero tolerance for any kind of scrutiny by the public. And there are lots of people, journalists, writers, poets, activists, human rights defenders, who have either been locked up or exiled or detained, beaten. It's a very politically very repressive place. It's socially in a better place than it was 5 years ago.
And have the social advancements been made to quieten any political criticism internally?
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman genuinely wanted to open up the country. So he really came to prominence in 2015 after his father, King Salman, became king. And MBS, as he's known for short, Mohammed bin Salman, was made defense minister. He then took Saudi Arabia to war against Yemen, against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And that's been disastrous. It's gone on for 8 years and it's achieved almost nothing for Saudi Arabia. But he's got something called Vision 2030, which is a great sort of, I mean, he's had management consultants work on this. It's this great grandiose plan to wean Saudi Arabia off its dependence on both oil and on imported workers from poorer countries who keep the country going. I mean, the fact is, most Saudis don't want to do the jobs that Filipinos, Sri Lankans, Bangladeshis, Nigerians and others are prepared to do. So I think he's going to have an uphill challenge there. And you've got hundreds of thousands of Saudi school leavers and university graduates expecting a job. And that's going to be the real challenge for him. There isn't really a religious or political challenge to him anymore in the country. I mean, it's a pretty peaceful place on the whole now. But if he, in 5 years' time, has failed to find jobs for all these people, the gloss is going to come off. And the youth who currently support him may well be starting to grumble, I think. I mean, there is no outlet for political dissent whatsoever, either online, on the streets, in the newspapers, on the airwaves, at all. It's totally crushed. The deal has always been in Saudi Arabia that we, the government, the ruling family, the Al Saud, it's the only country in the world that is named after the family, they look after the country. Don't scrutinize the accounts. Don't start peering into who gets what amounts of money and stuff. In return, we'll look after you. You'll have a comfortable life, you'll be safe, and there will be jobs. But if those jobs aren't there, then people will want to have some kind of political say. I think that's still quite a long way down the line. There have been various books over the years talking about the decline and inevitable collapse of the House of Saud. This is wishful thinking, mostly by people who don't like them. Saudis don't want to change their rulers, but they would like to be, I think, better ruled with more transparency, less corruption, and a bit more freedom.
What is the attitude of the key Western rulers towards Saudi Arabia in 2023? What is the view of Saudi Arabia towards the key Western rulers?
It all changed in 2018. Prior to that, I went to Saudi Arabia in 2017 for the first overseas visit by President Trump. He chose Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis loved Trump. They laid out the red carpet for him. Then came 2018 and the murder of Khashoggi. And prior to that, MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince, had a red carpet welcome, not just in London, Paris, Western capitals, but in Hollywood. There was pictures of him joshing away, sharing jokes with the Rock, with, you know, actors and Hollywood celebs. But that all changed with that hideous murder of Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, which the Saudis still saying, oh no, it wasn't government. These were just rogue actors. That's meant that ever since then, MBS, the Crown Prince, has been a bit of a pariah in Western circles. Less so with France. The French have welcomed him recently. But very tellingly, about a month after that murder, in November 2018, the G20 group of top economies in the world held their summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Now, Western leaders shunned MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince. They didn't want to be seen with him at all. Guess who got on really well with him? Putin. President Putin high-fived him. And MBS hasn't forgotten that, which is one of the reasons why today, when the US is trying to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to pump more oil, to lower prices at the pump, the Saudis are saying, yeah, we hear what you're saying, but no thanks. I think we'll do our own thing. And so there's not very good relations between, to come back to your question, there's pretty strained relations between the White House and the Saudis. They don't like the Biden administration. When Joe Biden was campaigning for office for president, he said, we're going to make Saudi Arabia the pariah that it is. And he's particularly blamed MBS, which is why last year, when humiliatingly he went to Jeddah to go meet the Saudi Crown Prince, they had that very awkward fist bump. I don't know if you remember it. They didn't shake hands. They didn't embrace. And there was a kind of awkward grimace on both men's faces. They can't stand each other. So even though the US is still the big security guarantor for Saudi, the Saudis are looking over the shoulder, looking over the horizon. They're looking to China, to Russia, to diversify their friends.
How multi-layered do you think is what they are doing at the moment within the sporting world? Whether that be what they've done at Newcastle, whether that be, you know, sponsorship deals in F1, heavyweight boxing, what they're now doing with the Saudi Pro League, what they've done with golf. Is all of this designed to work to send a message across the Middle East and Gulf and internally and to the West?
It's several fold. I mean, yes, of course, it's been accused of sports washing, of trying to rehabilitate the Saudi name and particularly Crown Prince MBS. But Saudis love sports. They're really keen on sports. I mean, for decades, there's been no public entertainment in Saudi. So Saudis are enormous, voracious consumers of, well, previously videos, now streaming of Netflix and home entertainment. Now that it's a bit more public, great, they want to go to sporting events. They want to watch Formula E. They want to go to these things, men and women mixing. I mean, famously, there have been concerts. David Guetta has played at live concerts where, you know, women are waving their mobile phones. And this would have been unheard of 5 years ago, because when Iran had its Islamic revolution in 1979, it forced Saudi Arabia, as the custodians of the two holiest places in Islam, Mecca and Medina, to then become quite conservative religiously. So that's all changed recently. And the religious police have been really kind of sidelined. And you've got to keep the young people occupied, or they will do things which parents don't approve of. So I think there's a genuine desire to find sporting outlets of people. But yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, Saudi Arabia is an enormously rich country with its public investment fund, which is basically a sovereign wealth fund of hundreds of billions of dollars. They can afford to pay huge amounts, eye-watering amounts, to buy players. And the Saudis, I think, have rightly, they've proved correct in the sense that they have said, we know we're going to get a bit of flack from human rights groups, but we know it'll pass. And ultimately, money buys everything. And the criticisms will fade away and we will become a powerhouse in sport. And that's exactly what they're becoming.
That was the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner, who, I'll be honest with you, I never thought I'd find myself in a situation talking about The Rock with Frank Gardner, but there we go. We have Adam Crafton with us, Ahmed Al-Omron as well. We'll talk about the actual football in just a moment. But just one on the word sport washing, the phrase sport washing, Adam, which is, we understand what it means, we understand how it operates, but in this day and age, certainly in this country, and you might tell me it's different in other European countries, as soon as something like the Saudi Pro League happens or a World Cup in Qatar, it can't be sport washing to a certain extent, because we constantly talk about it and discuss it. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, if you take it sort of as a very literal definition of, you know, as a way of cleansing dirty sheets in public and all of that kind of thing, well, it's proving to be the opposite of that, because there's been far more discussion, certainly in the United States, around the Gulf was triggered by that. And also in the UK as well. What I would say is I think over time, so I would agree with you in the short term. I think in the long term, perhaps the sporting investments have the potential for many of us to start viewing Saudi Arabia in a slightly different way. So, you know, you can already tell, I think there's a little bit of fatigue in the conversation around when people talk about Newcastle. It's like, well, do we still have to mention the human rights every time we talk about Newcastle? Do we have to mention Khashoggi? At what point do people decide we've talked about it enough and people know about it and just talk about football? And I think that's a really difficult thing going forward. I mean, what Frank was talking about was absolutely fascinating in terms of the way that Saudi is seen. The only thing I would add to that is, you know, Britain, I think, has an open invitation to Mohammed bin Salman to visit the country later this year, which they're basically just waiting for the Saudis to come back and pick his date. And, you know, one of the things that we know around the takeover of Newcastle was that Boris Johnson's government was encouraging the Premier League to approve this takeover. And that was because the Public Investment Fund has pledged $30 billion in direct investment into Britain over the next 10 years. So I think the Saudis know deep down that this will probably be limited to human rights groups and the media, because ultimately governing bodies, the state in major countries, are becoming very reliant on the Saudis, whether it is oil and gas as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war, or whether it's future investment in Britain because, you know, post-Brexit investment's not that easy to find.
Are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia, Ahmed, aware that these discussions go on, or aware that these discussions went on in America when LIV was founded, aware that these discussions are going on in certain media now, a load of players are joining the Saudi Pro League, or are they oblivious?
Not much with the golf deal, because golf is not a popular sport here. So the news of the golf merger and what followed merely got any coverage here. So that didn't really garner much discussion here. But with football being the most popular sport here, obviously, yes, there is more attention to the coverage of that and to accusations around it. So people are aware. But as Adam said, pro-government people say, well, if you think about it, these deals has brought more scrutiny, more criticism, more, you know, bad publicity and bad coverage. So the idea that they're doing this and they're spending this money to improve their image is backfiring in a sense.
Ahmed, is it making Saudis hostile to the West? I mean, ordinary everyday Saudis, when they see, I suppose, people like me who may have been critical of what's happening, is it changing perceptions of Western media and things like that?
Well, yes, because they perceive it as being unfair to them. We're trying to do a good thing. We're trying to grow the sport, to make our league more exciting, more fun, more better to watch. And you're focused on issues that people locally may not consider issues at all. Definitely there is hostility in the responses, but it's not just over this issue. I think it's been growing for a few years. As the international media covered Saudi over the last few years with more scrutiny, and as a sense of ultra-nationalism has been growing in the country, we have seen people becoming more and more hostile and rejecting to any, you know, Western coverage as being automatically negative and bad. They're just not being fair.
Did you not experience that, Adam, in Qatar at the World Cup? Because I certainly did. Angry expats in the main, actually, who would say but I could understand it from their point of view and the life they'd built there. Going, for God's sake, well, you know, there are positives to living here and being here. Why does everything have to be so critical and negative? That was what they were saying to us.
Yeah, and I think it became a deliberate communication strategy as well during the World Cup from the organisers of the Qatar World Cup to make this, in some ways, this was a very genuine thing, to make it feel as though it was this pan-Arab tournament, right? To say it was a celebration of Arab culture, the first Arab World Cup. Any attack on Qatar is also an attack on all of its neighbours, which kind of ignored the fact that Qatar had been in a really bad relationship with its neighbours for the 4 years leading up to the World Cup. And what they did very well was basically say any criticism is basically just anti-Arab. So any criticism of workers' rights, of any discussion, the whole discussion around the One Love armband, anything like that would be almost phrased as Islamophobic by the organisers of the World Cup. It was, why are you wasting our time talking about this thing when you should just be celebrating all of these fantastic things about Arab culture? Which, what, you know, we saw the best of that when Morocco, you know, get to the semi-finals. You have the mums on the pitch with the players. You had Saudi Arabia beating Argentina. That was my favourite day out in Qatar, because you had these Saudis coming over the border and you saw that real authentic passion for football. But at the same time, there was this very deliberate communication strategy to, I think, turn local people against Western media, who, whether criticism was fair or unfair.
I think it's always hard to strike the right balance between focusing on the issues around these events and around the sport, but at the same time, acknowledge the positives. I mean, in the eyes of Saudis, they think and they feel that a lot of positive has been done and that it doesn't get enough acknowledgement and that the Western media fails to see the big picture. But at the same time, from the perspective of critics, why do you want to get so much credit for doing the right things? You know, is allowing women to drive something we should congratulate you on for the next 10 years, for example? So it's always hard to strike the right balance as you try to cover and report on these issues. But, you know, you try your best and hope for the best.
That's it for part one. We'll continue our discussion, hear from Richard Masters, Pep Guardiola, and find out what it's like to play in Saudi Arabia in the second part of this special on the Football Daily feed.
Money, glamour, politics, spying, violence, takeovers, kidnapping, and photocopying. This is Sport's Strangest Crimes, from the man who tried to buy cricket.
One night, one game, winner take all, $20 million.
The kidnap of a superhorse.
It must have been terrifying.
Of course it was. How we got through with it on.
A $1 trillion takeover, which never took off.
Fraudsters of this level, they will never stop.
And an ill-advised errand changing F1 forever.
It will haunt the people involved for as long as they live.
Sport's Strangest Crimes. Listen on BBC Sounds.